This Week with George Stephanopoulos starts right now.
Breaking news reports that at least 17 U.S. missionaries and their families have been kidnapped in Haiti. What we're learning this morning. Logjam.
We need all hands on deck.
A supply chain crisis, empty shelves, and rising prices. President Biden calling on businesses to break the bottleneck.
We came to the port of Long Beach to see for ourselves how this unprecedented situation is affecting us all.
We follow the supply chain from the port.
You've been here for a month?
Yes.
What are you seeing, really, on a day-to-day basis? To stores.
Don't panic buy, but just make sure that you're prepared.
The latest this morning. And an FDA panel recommends Johnson & Johnson boosters for a wide group. Those 18 and older, are they at greater risk? Now, questions on mixing and matching vaccines. Dr. Anthony Fauci joins us this morning. Plus, out of the shadows.
Most of the world first heard your name about 5 years ago, but you stayed silent. Why speak out now?
The former British spy who released that infamous dossier on Trump and Russia speaks exclusively to George Stephanopoulos.
From ABC News, it's This Week. Here now, co-anchor Martha Raddatz.
Good morning and welcome to This Week. As crippling supply chain disruptions continue, many Americans are waking up to higher prices and product shortages. The cost of shipping containers soaring during the global pandemic, colliding with a labor shortage, all likely to impact the holiday season. We traveled to one of the nation's busiest ports, where so many massive cargo ships are waiting to be unloaded. Much more of our first-hand look coming up. As the country grapples with this bottleneck, some encouraging news in the battle against COVID-19. Nationwide, the daily case average and hospitalizations have dropped after the lethal summer Delta surge, and nearly 70% of adults now fully vaccinated. And this week, an FDA panel recommended a booster shot for some Americans who received the Moderna or Johnson & Johnson vaccine. But there are lingering questions about mixing and matching vaccines, shots for young children, and upcoming holiday gatherings. Dr. Anthony Fauci is standing by. But first, the breaking news this morning reports that at least 17 American missionaries and their families and children have been abducted by a gang in Haiti. Our ABC correspondent Victor Oquendo joins us now from outside the Haitian consulate in New York City with the latest. Good morning, Victor.
Good morning, Martha. This is all according to an audio message from the Ohio-based Christian Aid Ministries, and it was first reported by the New York Times. 17 missionaries from the United States, including children, kidnapped overnight as they were going home after building an orphanage. The State Department saying that they are aware, but didn't have much else to add besides saying that the safety of U.S. citizens abroad is one of the highest priorities. The kidnapping is just the latest incident in a country reeling from an alarming surge in gang-related kidnappings, more than 600 so far this year. That's according to Haiti's Center for Analysis and Research in Human Rights. And that is just one crisis facing Haitians. The country still in turmoil after President Jovenel Moise's assassination in July and that devastating 7.2 magnitude earthquake in August that killed more than 2,200 people and destroyed more than 1,000 homes. Martha?
Thanks, Victor. Now for the latest on the COVID pandemic, let's bring in Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, the FDA advisory panel unanimously recommended booster doses for the J&J vaccine, but the advice is for all people over 18 to get the shot, even after just 2 months. We know this vaccine was not as effective as others. So should those 15 million people who got the vaccine be concerned given these recommendations?
No, not at all, Martha. I think that they should feel good about it because what the advisors to the FDA felt is that given the data that they saw, very likely this should have been a two-dose vaccine to begin with. So the idea of making a recommendation that people who originally received J&J should receive a second dose, 18 or older, with none of the restrictions about whether or not you're at a high risk or not at a high risk, is that everyone who received that first dose of J&J who are 18 and older should receive it. So I think that's a very good thing. And I think it's very favorable for those who have received the J&J vaccine. I don't see that as a problem at all.
But Dr. Fauci, the panel was also looking at new data that suggests J&J recipients may be better off getting a booster shot from the more effective Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. Is that a better solution?
You know, that is true. The data you referred to, that if you boost people who have originally received J&J with either Moderna or Pfizer, the level of antibodies that you induce in them is much higher than if you boost them with the original J&J. However, you're talking about laboratory data, which very often are reflective of what you would see clinically. But the data of boosting the J&J first dose with the J&J second dose is based on clinical data. So what's going to happen is that the FDA is going to look at all those data, look at the comparison, and make a determination of what they will authorize. Once an authorization is made, then the ACIP, or the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, that advises the CDC, will then make a recommendation of what people who have been receiving and had received the J&J should do. So it's going to be a process of authorization first, and then a recommendation after considering all the data.
And what do you think, Dr. Fauci? How would they be better off for all those people out there who took a J&J?
You know, Martha, I think it's going to be variable depending upon who you are. For example, a woman of childbearing age who would have almost no issues at all with a possible adverse event of myocarditis, which you see rarely, but you do see it with the mRNA vaccine, that person might want to opt for that approach. If you're a young man who does have that very, very rare risk of getting a myocarditis, you might want to take the J&J route. So really, I think it's going to be individual. So what likely will happen is that both the FDA and their authorization and the CDC will likely give a degree of flexibility based on the individual situation.
And the advisory committee also recommended a third dose of the Moderna shot for those over 65, just like the Pfizer shot as well. What's the timeline for expanding those categories to different age groups?
Well, that's going to depend. Well, that's a great question, Martha. That's going to really depend on the data that comes in, because what we're dealing with data rolling in real time, not only from the cohorts that the CDC is following, but also in real time, we're getting very important data from Israel, because as I've said so often, Israel is about a month and a half ahead of us temporally with their vaccination and with the data that they're seeing about the waning of immunity, as well as the advantage of boosting people at different age groups. So the data we're starting to see from Israel indicates that even in the somewhat younger group, for example, from 40 to 60, there's a real benefit in getting the booster shot. So what we'll be doing here in the United States, both through the FDA and the CDC, will be to following these data as they accumulate in real time. And any modification of the recommendations will be based on that data as they come in.
And as for children, I know you believe that it'll be early November before 5 to 11-year-olds can get vaccinated.
Well, the timeline, Martha, is that the FDA will be looking at the data from Pfizer. I believe it's October the 26th. They'll make a regulatory determination, and then likely the next week, which would probably be the first couple of days in November, then the CDC will do what they do. They'll have their advisory committee on immunization practices look at the data and make a recommendation. So I think the timeline that we discussed previously is really still on the timetable that we spoke about.
And Dr. Fauci, lastly, we know the best way to keep safe is to be vaccinated. But what are your guidelines for the upcoming holidays? Will you be giving out Halloween candy? What do we do Thanksgiving, Christmas, and the other holidays?
Well, Martha, I believe strongly that, particularly in the vaccinated people, if you're vaccinated and your family members are vaccinated, those who are eligible, and that is obviously very young children are not yet eligible, that you can enjoy the holidays. You can enjoy Halloween, trick-or-treating and certainly Thanksgiving with your family and Christmas with your families. That's one of the reasons why we emphasize why it's so important to get vaccinated, not only for your own safety, for that of your family, but also for the good of the community to keep the level of infection down. When you do that, there's no reason at all why you can't enjoy the holidays in a family way, the way we've traditionally done it all along.
Okay, well, that's very good news. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Dr. Fauci.
Good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
And as we mentioned, the Biden administration faces another crisis amid a growing backlog in the global supply chain. The president announced new measures with ports and major shippers to ease the strain.
This is across-the-board commitment to going to 24/7. This is a big first step in speeding up the movement of materials and goods through our supply chain.
But with consumer demand growing, factories struggling to keep up, and a shortage of workers from the ports to truck drivers, there is little relief in sight. We traveled to the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, where 40% of all cargo goods enter the U.S. to see for ourselves.
Here off the coast of Southern California, on the waters of the country's busiest ports, record numbers of container ships sitting idle.
Right now in the port of Long Beach, there are more than 60 container ships anchored here waiting to unload. Normally, there wouldn't be any of them waiting. And those are just the ones you can see way out in the Pacific. There are dozens more.
On board these ships, that couch you ordered, computers, refrigerators, medical supplies, and toys, hoping to reach Santa in time for Christmas.
Martha, I have never seen anything like this. This is actually one of the smaller ships. The largest ships in service today can carry up to 24,000 container units.
And what would that mean in terms of goods?
That could fill three shopping malls.
Long Beach Port's Deputy Executive Director Noel Hasegawa said it all began with COVID.
Was this something that just wasn't planned for?
Well, the pandemic had the effect of impacting every segment of the supply chain. When manufacturing was shut down in Asia, we had very little business here. Starting in July, we noticed this surge, this tsunami of cargo. So we went from doom and gloom to fast and furious on a turn of a dime, and that caught the supply chain off guard.
When the economy began showing signs of improvement, consumer demand, online shopping already thriving, grew as well. The Port of Los Angeles is averaging around 900,000 containers per month, projecting 10.8 million this year, a 17% increase from 2020, with no signs of incoming ships slowing down. But even if they are lucky enough to get into the port,
hello,
they sit and wait in this cargo campground.
You've been here for a month?
Yes.
Long time.
It's taking three times longer to clear vessels at the ports compared to before the pandemic. And the Long Beach port is already working 24/7.
Start to order now.
Matt Schrapp, CEO of the Harbor Trucking Association, says working 24/7 won't solve everything.
The challenges is space on the one hand, and then enough vessels capacity that's available to move those containers back to their point of origin.
Backlogged empty containers contributing to a shortage around the world, dramatically increasing the cost of shipping. From China to the U.S., roughly $1,300 to more than $16,000. What took an average of 41 days now takes 75. Adding to strained operations at the ports, there's labor shortages at every step in the supply chain. From the longshoremen to warehouse workers to what could be the most dire, a need for tens of thousands of truck drivers nationwide.
We've had a worker shortage on truck drivers now long before we had record-breaking cargo. That has been a huge issue.
Mayor Robert Garcia, who has been working with the administration, hopes the backlog will ease in his city's port in the next few weeks. But others predict it could take months or even far longer.
The best estimates that I've heard, this could be something that will be well into next Christmas, to be honest with you.
And as all these supply chain issues come to a head, they are hitting retailers and consumers directly. Inflation for the month of September hit 5.4% over the past year, matching a 13-year high. Prices have increased for items like new cars, TVs, gas, food, and furniture. Wendy Ortiz, owner of Caravana Furniture in Long Beach, told me manufacturers are continuing to increase prices and delivery times have been unprecedented.
It used to take about 2 to 3 days. Now it's sometimes it's taking a month. I even had a client that was waiting almost a year to get her furniture.
Sparking fears for holiday shopping. Heather Rasmussen, owner of Pixie Toys, feels prepared for the holiday season, but said she's already had parents shop for Christmas.
As a parent, I would say don't panic buy, but just make sure that you're prepared with everything that you need.
Let's take a closer look at this with our experts now. Diane Swonk, chief economist and managing director at Grant Thornton, and ABC News business correspondent Deirdre Bolton. Welcome to you both. And Diane, I want to start with you. I understand how all these factors came together in the supply chain, but isn't this something we should have seen coming?
You know, it's really hard. There's no roadmap for opening up a global economy all at once. And it was much easier to turn the lights out on the economy, the global economy, than ramp up factories and turn things back on. We had a demand surge, and then we had all these glitches that got exacerbated by the pandemic itself. And people keep forgetting that we're still in a global pandemic. Delta was a game changer and added to all these problems that we're seeing globally in terms of delaying the shipments and idling plants in places that had escaped earlier waves.
It really was an extraordinary scene out there, Deirdre. And I know a lot of the blame is on the pandemic, but when you have that glut of ships, you said it's a lot like what happened with the auto industry.
It certainly is. And it speaks to this fact that it really was a perfect storm, because even the auto industry business leaders, they thought we were going into a recession. No one's going to want to buy cars. What happened? Everyone wanted a car. People who lived in cities became nervous about being on public transportation. A lot of people moved out of cities. So the demand for cars went through the roof. I actually went to car dealerships where normally you were sort of three cars per line. There was one car and really almost a third of the inventory. So it just showed you, once the business leaders decided, okay, we're gonna tell these chip makers we don't need the chips, those chips went into other products, and it just kicked off this domino effect that we've seen in so many industries.
And the White House attempted this week to solve all this, and one of the things they want to do is that 24/7. Frankly, some of those ports already are working 24/7. So what can the federal government really do now?
You know, there's a really great op-ed by Chad Bown from the Peterson Institute and Neil Irwin in the New York Times, and it really lays out that any kind of supply chain issues, even if you declare them defense issues, the security issues, you can't just nationalize them. You need to coordinate with other countries, with our allies, and it will cost more to do that. But if you really want to ensure it, we really need to think much more holistically and coordinate. And that's not something we've been so good about in recent years.
Or that you can do quickly, for sure.
Exactly.
The toy store owner at the end of that piece, Deirdre, said, don't panic buy, but make sure you get things. Is this going to start panic buying?
I do think we've seen some panic buying, even what we just alluded to with the cars. It's already happened. I mean, with tons of other products. But of course, as we're nearing the holiday season, yes, I do think most experts say if you see something that you want, just buy it now, because there are really no guarantees it will be there, let's say, 3 or 4 weeks from now, or that it will be available 3 or 4 weeks at the same price. I mean, I think inflation.
So holiday shopping could be in trouble.
Absolutely. It certainly could be. And I think what's clear is for most goods, we can all assume we will pay at least 10% more for most items.
And Diane, we saw the problems at the ports with truckers, and there really is a lack of workers.
Yeah.
How did this happen?
Yeah, it's like we went through the looking glass. We have labor shortages with millions of workers still not back in their jobs. But there's many reasons, everything from childcare, which we know is hurdles to women returning to work, and the fact that schools go back into quarantine, but also many people delayed and deferred their educational attainment. Sadly, many people dropped out of high school and kindergarten through 12, in addition to not being able to finish their degrees. Also, retirement surged, and there's been this huge reset. Over half of all workers are sort of saying, I'm not sure I want to work the way I did and in the same place I did, which has soared in terms of quit rates. So we really are in this alternative universe that is not going to dissipate anytime soon.
And Deirdre, we've got these labor disputes with places like Kellogg, John Deere. Workers seem to be sensing they're in a pretty strong position.
They are in a pretty strong position. When what I find is interesting is that organized labor is at the lowest that it's ever been in the United States. But yet public sentiment is very much with these workers. And you just alluded to some of the companies. I mean, it's really across numerous industries. And I think there is this idea, there's one interesting stat. There are more than 700 billionaires in the U.S. with a collective net worth of $4.7 trillion. That is more than double what the lower 50% net worth of Americans is. So it just, this idea of income inequality, I think public opinion is very much shifting towards the worker. It's kind of what Diane says. I mean, economists and the government were amazing at counting the number of jobs. We are a ton less amazing at counting the quality of jobs. And that's what these workers are talking about. That's what a lot of people are feeling, even in professional and business services. Hey, my life changed a lot over the past 2 years. I don't know if I want to keep working like I was.
And Diane, I just want to end with inflation and what we're looking at here. The shortage of goods seems to be driving up prices. Will this hang around for a long time?
You know, my concern is that, yes, inflation will abate as we resolve some of these supply chain problems, but it's not going to abate enough to be insignificant. We've got shelter costs accelerating. That's a third of the CPI. And that's going to happen right into 2022. And it's going to put the Federal Reserve and policymakers in a very difficult position where inflation remains elevated and noticeable enough and a problem for many workers at the same time that you don't know if it's going to resolve itself in 2023, you don't want to snuff out demand and make things worse for these workers down the road, but it is going to be a very tough call going forward.
Okay, thanks very much to both of you. The roundtable weighs in next and later. The first look at George Stephanopoulos' exclusive interview with former MI6 spy Christopher Steele, author of that infamous dossier on Trump and Russia. We'll be right back.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
Congressional subpoenas on the January 6th committee.
I hope that the committee goes after them and holds them accountable.
Should they be prosecuted by the Justice Department?
I do, yes.
President Biden suggesting the Justice Department should prosecute Trump allies who refuse subpoenas from the House's January 6th committee. Let's talk about that and more on the roundtable with our ABC News team, Chief Washington Correspondent John Carl, also a co-anchor of This Week, Weekend White House Correspondent Mary Alice Parks, Political Director Rick Klein, and ABC Correspondent Stephanie Ramos. Welcome to all of you. And John, I want to talk to you first. We have this massive supply chain that we've been talking about this morning. Going into the holidays, inflation up 5.4% over the past year. How much of a political problem is this for President Biden?
Well, empty store shelves, people unable to buy Christmas presents. That's not a good thing for the president, to say the least. But I think the biggest concern here is, does this lead to even more inflation? You know, Martha, one of the numbers I saw, sets of numbers I saw this week that really hit home on this is the cost of shipping a container from China. If you go back to 2019, pre-pandemic, it was about $1,300. Now, $16,000 to bring a container from China. That ripples through the supply chain. It makes things, it's going to make things more expensive. High inflation. And look, the biggest factor here, the single biggest factor, is that people are buying more stuff. So there's an underlying bit of good news here. People have the means and desire to buy more things. The problem is the supply chain has not caught up.
And the White House did announce this 24/7. Actually, some of them were already doing that. I saw that there in the ports. But you can't really do that if you don't have enough workers. Did the White House move quickly enough on this, Mary Alice?
Yeah, they want to show that they're on it. They're getting private companies together. But unless they take extreme measures, I mean, unless all of a sudden we're talking about the National Guard unloading container ships, we're really talking about the White House putting public pressure on private companies. And in that way, getting involved is sort of a catch-22. They had to do it early. They have to show that they're paying attention. But at some point now, they own this because he's been involved. And that's risky because, like I said, there's not actually that much the White House can do day to day except continue to put pressure on these private companies.
And then keep going out and talking about it and saying it's under control. And speaking of that, Stephanie, the Treasury Secretary said she thinks the prices will go down soon and there's no need to panic. That's not what I heard out there. That's not what I'm hearing across the country. But we're talking about medical supplies. We're talking beyond the economy. We're talking about military families who can't get their furniture and household goods back from deployments in Asia. This is really hitting the American public.
It really is. And American families, they're the ones that are feeling this. And it's hard when you're in it to be in the mind frame of in the next 6 months, we'll get away from this and things will be better. They are in it right now and trying to survive so that when they are going to the grocery store and seeing these increased prices, where is the comfort? Where are the tools to help them? But the Treasury Secretary is saying this is transitory, but also saying that this isn't going away in the next month or so. And I spoke with the Deputy Secretary a few days ago, and I asked him, was there anything the Biden administration could have done to prevent this, to get ahead of this, to prepare for this? And he didn't exactly answer that, but did say that this was expected, that the economy just hasn't transitioned with us out of this pandemic. And says it's going to take time. He says the president, of course, is focused on these issues. He touted the American Rescue Plan, the emergency impact payments, the child tax credit, and says it is going to take a while for the supply chain to catch up with the demand.
And meanwhile, there is going to be panic buying.
Absolutely.
No
absolutely.
About that, I think.
When you say don't panic, people tend to panic.
Exactly. Right. Don't panic, but make sure your shelves are stocked.
And when you start talking about Christmas.
Yes.
And order now.
Panic. Yeah. And Christmas and your children, and you definitely want to do that. Rick, we're still more than a year out, however, from the midterms, but the economy is clearly becoming a huge issue, and the Republicans already taking advantage of that, doubling down on this.
Yeah, think about it. The election's about pocketbook issues. If your pocketbook feels that much lighter because you can't afford things. And Republicans see now an emerging set of issues like inflation, like rising gas prices, like rising crime rates, and of course the fact that the pandemic is still ongoing. And they say this is a brew of issues that they can make into something against Democrats. They say, look, they promised that they would bring some stability, but there hasn't been that kind of stability in your life across this range of issues. And this inflation thing in particular is problematic on another level, because guess who keeps talking about inflation as a concern? As Democrats debate these bills, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, one of the big holdouts on this, he's worried about the idea of pumping even more trillions of dollars into an economy that might already be overheated with excessive demand.
And he's worried about a lot of things. And John, of course, on Capitol Hill, we have the infrastructure, the spending bill. What's the progress on that? We know Nancy Pelosi has now set a deadline.
Halloween. I don't think that deadline is going to be met. But Steny Hoyer, who runs the floor schedule, says there will be votes coming up on both the infrastructure bill and this larger social infrastructure bill. But it's not looking good. You saw Bernie Sanders, who, of course, has been leading the charge for a big social infrastructure bill, the budget chairman. He actually wrote an op-ed in one of the West Virginia papers going right at Joe Manchin, saying that by standing in the way, Joe Manchin is hurting West Virginians. And Joe Manchin responded with a blistering statement. I mean, Martha, I want to just read a sentence from this. I will not vote for a reckless expansion of government programs. No op-ed from a self-declared independent socialist is going to change that. So it doesn't look like Bernie Sanders' efforts to pressure Joe Manchin have gotten him any closer to voting for this. And remember, they can't do it without him.
No, they can't do that. And Stephanie, we saw this week in Connecticut on Friday, the president trying to sell his agenda. And he said they might have to cut out, made some implication that they might have to cut out community college, that for all. And Joe Manchin is against a lot of these climate controls.
He absolutely is. And that's right. We heard President Biden. We've heard a lot of this from him on the campaign trail and in office. He's proposed the 2 years of free tuition-free community college. And it was kind of stunning to hear him doubt that that could make it into this final version of the package or that it would need to be adjusted in some way. But at this point, it's on the chopping block. And when you hear Joe Manchin come out against some of these programs, it's troubling because the administration and Democrats need all the Democratic support that they can get. And Manchin, of course, against the clean electricity program.
He's in West Virginia.
And, you know, the White House has said that they are sticking with their plan. This is part of the president's big plan to battle climate change. But we'll have to see in the next few days if that happens, if they stick with their plan, because, of course, they're trying to get this package over the line.
And Mary Alice, many of the workers going on strike around the country, we've seen a lot of those suggestions of strikes, pushing for benefits that Democrats want in the spending bill. Are they capitalizing on this?
Senator Sanders is trying to. His team told me that he sent pizzas to those on the picket lines with John Deere, that the senator was on the phone with one of the strike leaders there with the John Deere workers. But they, you know, to your point, they know that those that are on the picket lines are making some of their arguments for them. They're not only asking for more pay, they're asking for more benefits, things like paid medical leave. Progressives say, great, that's in the bill. They're asking for things like pensions and help with childcare, you know, some of those issues that are keeping people out of the labor force right now. And Democrats are saying we're trying to address that in the bill. But to John's point about the deadline, I mean, the Sanders folks kind of laughed at the idea of meeting that October 31st deadline. I talked to a former Manchin staffer who said that deadline was laughable. They've known for a long time that those climate provisions are the crux of what has these two sides colliding. And they have to come to sit around a table together and actually just hash this out. But it seems right now they're still just too far apart to do that.
Okay, John, your prediction. How long does this go? What happens? I know you don't like to predict, but
I don't like predictions, especially about the future.
Yes.
But but look, I think that there's a recognition among Democrats that failure on both of these is truly not an option. There's actually more at stake than even the fundamentals of what are in these bills. It's really the success or failure of the Biden presidency. That said, how you actually cobble this together is unclear. You know, with House Democrats signaling there will be votes on both of these bills, and it wasn't like unless the Senate's, you know, done everything on the social infrastructure bill. No, there will be votes on these bills. So it seems to me that they will at least get one of these across the line, not necessarily by Halloween, but they will get at least one of these across the line.
So much attention on this in Washington. But, Rick, I was stunned by the CNN poll. Let me read it. Only a quarter of Americans think their lives will be better off if both the infrastructure and social spending bills pass. More than 4 in 10 said they wouldn't make a difference, and about a third said they'd be worse off. It really does seem like whatever they're doing on the Hill, the Democrats aren't selling it to the American
people. A massive failure to communicate what's in the bill, in part because they don't actually know what's in the bill. Mm-hmm. Well, how can you sell this? But think about that. They are talking about the largest expansion in social service spending in American history, and only one-fourth of people think it's actually better for them. This, to me, has real shades of the health care debate from more than a decade ago. I've talked to a number of Democrats who've made the point that they failed throughout that to communicate what the stakes were. They got bogged down in the process, and by the time they got over the finish line, it was defined politically. And the idea that even if you pass this now, that you can then go out and make the case that this works for people, they're betting so many of their midterm hopes on that and recovery from COVID, things that ultimately may be out of their control because perceptions have gotten away from them. This is a big problem that Democrats are worried about, that even if they get it done, they're not going to be able to make much of it.
And John, I want to move to January 6th. We saw that at the top of the show there. The Select Committee investigating the attack on the Capitol moved to hold former Trump advisor Steve Bannon in criminal contempt for refusing to comply with the subpoena. You write about this in your upcoming book next month that we're all looking forward to. But what happens now with these subpoenas?
Well, the Bannon subpoena and the Bannon fight is about much more than just Steve Bannon, because the committee wants to talk to everybody that was around Donald Trump on January 6th. And this is the test case. Can they compel Steve Bannon to testify? Martha, Congress doesn't have its own prosecutors. Congress doesn't have its own jail cells. Congress has very little, or if in fact, really no ability to actually enforce these subpoenas. That's why what you heard from Biden was so significant. He is saying that he wants to see the Justice Department, which does have the power to enforce this, but has not in the past, come in and prosecute Steve Bannon. Now, the Justice Department quickly put out a statement making it clear this is not the president's call. It's an independent Justice Department that will make the decision on prosecuting, but it sure looks like they will prosecute Bannon. It's a lengthy process. This will be a big court fight, and the question is, can they get all this done in time to actually matter for their investigation?
And Mary Alice, the president also rejected former President Trump's executive privilege claim instructing the National Archives to comply with the committee's documents, but Trump is almost certainly going to fight this.
Right, that's the expectation, is that the Trump team does in fact sue. But I think it's important to note that they haven't yet. So we're kind of all bracing for this legal showdown, but we'll see what that lawsuit actually looks like. There's a lot of legal scholars that say the former president doesn't have a great case. This hasn't been tested in the courts yet. Steve Bannon probably has an even weaker case, right? How do you say that you have an executive privilege claim when you didn't work in the White House for several years before? But you're exactly right. The White House has been totally on board with helping this committee. They have said that they want everyone to cooperate. In fact, the White House counsel said that they wanted the National Archives to give over those documents within 30 days, absent any court order.
And Stephanie, there's also a new charge, the January 6th insurrection, an actual Capitol police officer. Tell us about that. It really does tell you we don't know all of what happened up there. If we're still learning these things, they're still making arrests.
Exactly. So many months later, and it really shows you that authorities have not stopped trying to track down the individuals that took part in the January 6th riot, even 10 months or so later. Now you have this Capitol police officer who has a whole lot of questions to answer as he faces obstruction charges. He was there that day responding to the scene, but then the very next day was trying to help one of the insurrectionists by telling him to take down some of the Facebook messages telling him to take down some posts showing that that person was there, trying to protect them and saying, hey, I'm looking out for you. But this is just one of about 600 or so Capitol riot cases. And it's an unusual one because it involves a Capitol police officer. So he is on paid administrative leave. He has not entered a plea, but it really just goes to show you that so many months later, authorities are trying to figure out who these individuals are that tried to get into the Capitol, and then who was inside and tried to help them.
And Rick, very quickly, we have about 30 seconds left. There was a rally in Virginia, the gubernatorial race there, and they were actually taking a pledge of allegiance to one of the flags carried right before the insurrection.
Yeah, it's absolutely stunning, and it plays right into Democrats' hands, frankly, because their argument for the midterms and for the gubernatorial race in a few weeks is, remember January 6th. Remember what President Trump did. Remember what those Trump years were like, including the messy end. And as much as Republicans try to distance themselves from it, this is going on inside their base. And this is a real thing that you're going to continue to see play out as far as Democrats go.
And they really will have to continue to see that. Thanks so very much to all of you this morning. Always great to have you.
The Supreme Court has allowed a state law to stand that deputizes citizens, anyone, to proclaim themselves in a position to have a right under law to interfere with those choices that woman has made. The United States Department of Justice is prepared to take action and to sue.
Vice President Kamala Harris last month, and that near total abortion ban in Texas is now headed back to the Supreme Court. Just the latest twist in a blockbuster court term that could determine the future of the constitutional right to an abortion and the outcome of the 2022 midterms. So which voters could be more energized? 538's Nate Silver analyzes.
It's probably time to revisit some of our assumptions about the politics of abortion. The conventional wisdom is that while there are plenty of pro-choice voters and plenty of pro-life voters, conservatives are more likely to view abortion as a decisive issue for their vote. Back in February, for example, around 47% of Trump voters said abortion was a very important issue for them as compared to 39% of Biden voters, according to polling from YouGov. But we've seen a big change since September 1st when the Supreme Court allowed a highly restrictive Texas abortion law to remain in effect. In the most recent YouGov polling, about 51% of Biden voters describe abortion as very important, as compared to just 36% of Trump voters. That may be because voters get particularly motivated when you're potentially taking away something they thought they already had. The Texas law, for example, has been interpreted by experts as a signal that the Roe v. Wade decision could be overturned, a decision that remains quite popular, often by 2-to-1 margins in the polls. A recent Quinnipiac University poll, for instance, found that 67% of voters generally agree with Roe v. Wade, as compared to 27% opposed. One can perhaps draw a parallel to Obamacare, which motivated Republicans in the 2010 midterms because it reflected a change to the status quo. But by the 2018 midterms, when Obamacare was the law of the land, it had become fairly popular. And Republican members of Congress were punished by voters for their efforts to take it away. So I want to be careful here, both because of the sensitivity of the topic and because abortion is one of many issues that will affect the vote next year. But I surely do buy the Democrats will be motivated if they see Roe v. Wade as being under threat.
Did the heads of the intelligence agencies provide you with a 2-page summary of these unsubstantiated allegations?
I saw the information. I read the information outside of that meeting. It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. Does anyone really believe that story? I'm also very much of a germaphobe, by the way. Believe me.
He's the world's most famous and infamous spy, the man behind a series of intelligence reports containing explosive allegations of collusion between Russia and Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, the so-called Steele dossier. Now, former MI6 officer Christopher Steele is speaking out for the first time in a worldwide exclusive interview with our George Stephanopoulos, answering tough questions about his credibility, the dossier's accuracy, and that notorious claim the Russians held a salacious tape of Trump. Here's a sneak preview.
Most of the world first heard your name about 5 years ago, but you stayed silent up until now. Why speak out now?
I think there are several reasons. I think the first and most important is that the problems we identified back in 2016 haven't gone away and arguably have actually got worse. And I thought it was important to come and set the record straight.
One big claim in the dossier, the FBI, according to the Inspector General's report, and Mueller reinforces it, is not true, is the claim that Michael Cohen had a meeting with Russians in Prague. Do you accept that finding, that it didn't happen?
No, I don't.
Michael Cohen was Trump's personal lawyer and self-described fixer. The Steele dossier had alleged Cohen met secretly with Kremlin officials in Prague. Those were allegations the FBI later said were not true, according to the Inspector General report.
I've never been to Prague.
Never have.
I've never been to the Czech Republic.
Michael Cohen has completely turned on Donald Trump. He's accused him of all kinds of things. He's gone to jail. It defies logic that if he did this, he wouldn't say so now.
I don't agree with that. It's self-incriminating to a very great degree.
Since he's gone to prison, since he's turned on President Trump, he's told every single story. Why wouldn't he admit to this?
Because I think it's so incriminating and demeaning. And the other reason is he might be scared of the consequences.
Michael Cohen said to ABC News, "I eagerly await Steele's next secret dossier, which proves the existence of Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, and that Elvis is still alive."
Do you think it hurts your credibility at all that you won't accept the findings of the FBI in this particular case?
I'm prepared to accept that not everything in the dossier is 100% accurate. I have yet to be convinced that that is one of them.
Christopher Steele is free to believe whatever he wants. But if Christopher Steele wants other people to believe that he's believable, he needs to show us what evidence he has to support his belief.
The Inspector General also pulled back the curtain on how Steele had gathered his information. It doesn't name Steele's collector, but the report does describe some of his methods. And we'd later learn he was not someone well-placed in the Kremlin, but an analyst in Washington.
When the FBI sought this person out and interviewed him,
He said, yeah, he basically gathered some of this information, but he was almost ambivalent about how accurate it was.
Some of this information, including that allegation about the salacious tape, had apparently been gathered from people who had just heard about it or talked about it in jest.
One of your main collectors spoke to the inspector general, said that especially the compromise was word of mouth and hearsay, conversations with friends over beers. It was just talk.
If you have a confidential source and that confidential source is blown or is uncovered, that confidential source will often take fright and try and downplay and underestimate what they've said and done. And I think that's probably what happened here.
He's afraid?
I think anybody that's named in this context, particularly if they're Russian, has every reason to be afraid.
So you stand by the dossier?
I stand by the work we did, the sources that we had, and the professionalism which we applied to it.
Bearing in mind that this was raw intelligence. Raw intelligence in the sense that what we sent over was the initial findings.
Raw intelligence is just that. It's like throwing a lot of stuff against the wall.
All the talk about this alleged tape, I bet you've heard about it, virtually no evidence came forward in public to corroborate it.
It would be quite the tape if it became public. But it's now 5 years later, and we haven't seen a trace of it.
And today, do you still believe that that tape exists?
I think it probably does, but I wouldn't put 100% certainty on it.
So how do you explain if that tape does indeed exist, it hasn't been released?
Well, it hasn't needed to be released.
Why not?
Because I think the Russians felt they'd got pretty good value out of Donald Trump when he was president of the U.S.
Our thanks to George. Out of the Shadows, the man behind the Steele dossier, begins streaming tomorrow only on Hulu. That's all for us today. Thanks for sharing part of your Sunday with us. Check out World News Tonight and have a good day.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.